Aha.
Sorry about that. The title of this sermon, Race and Global Warming, threw two topics together merely because neither were mentioned in any of the presidential debates, so I thought I ought to mention them sometime before the election days. So there, I've done it. But political language and political discussions remind me of Johnny Most. That name mean anything to you? Anybody here? Johnny Most was the play-by-play radio announcer for the Boston Celtics for many, many years, certainly through the 60s and 70s, and when I was in the Boston area in the 80s. So he went from the era of Bob Cousy and Bill Russell to Larry Bird and Kevin McHale. And he was an interesting radio voice because it sounded as though he'd smoked about three packs of Camels every day since he was 12. He talked about like this, and Cousy goes in for the layup. It was really quite singular. I knew he was there because I was a big basketball fan, and I was looking forward to hearing his play-by-play on those occasions when I might be in the car and listening to it on the radio and so forth. And what I found was, especially if I ever had a chance to listen to his radio play-by-play commentary while I was also watching it on television, that it seemed to me that the game that Johnny Most was announcing bore no more than the most superficial similarity to the game I was watching. Because Johnny Most was so partisan to the Celtics that every touch by an opposing player on a Celtic was an assault. And every assault by a Boston player on an opposite player was a love tap. And so it went in terms of everything that was going on. And I realized that more and more political commentary has the same attachment to the truth the Johnny Most play-by-plays approach to the Celtics had. But at least when I was listening to Johnny Most, I could trust the score. But since Gore versus Bush, we can't even trust the score. And that's a problem with covering politics like a sporting event. Yogi Berra famously said, "It ain't over till it's over." But in politics, it ain't over even after it's over. As important as this election is, very little will be settled in the world or our nation, even if a winner is clear on November 7th. How would a President Romney really work with Congress if he makes good on his promise to first repeal Obamacare? How would a second-term President Obama work with a Congress whose avowed most sacred task was to deny him that second term? And we see every day the influence of the Citizens United decision, which has made even more apparent the old Bob Dylan line, "Money doesn't talk, it swears." Additional money hasn't brought additional speech in any real sense of the word. What it has done is increased the amount of noise so that meaningful speech is drowned out in a cacophony of pandering and hate mongering. I have a friend who worked for many years as a counsel to various congressional committees, and he once told me, even though he himself was a Wall Street Republican, that he did not trust states' rights because it was not that hard to buy a state legislature, but that no one could buy the whole U.S. Congress. This is no longer true. The traditional role of the prophet, you know, is to speak truth to power. But to use another cliche from the movies, It seems anymore, the power can't handle the truth. The role of the prophet, I dare say, God willing, the role of the next president will be to speak truth to the people. One might forgive any candidate for failing to sound the prophetic voice in an election campaign. This country and this world can no longer afford to hear the truth, can no longer afford not to hear the truth once this election is decided. If it comes from the president, we will be living in one of those rare moments of American history. And if it does not, it must come from somewhere. I heard a pundit say in a rare accident of meaning that global warming was not mentioned in the presidential debates because there were no votes to be gained by either side by mentioning it. This may just possibly have changed in the last week. The most hopeful thing I've seen in all this political season was watching Barack Obama and Chris Christie make nice. A smart, pragmatic Democrat and a smart, pragmatic Republican working together in the real world to get things done. I'm convinced that this is all about 80% of the American people want. To decouple global warming from fundamentalist theology and fundamentalist capitalism. We've had a little taste of gas shortages this week. How about this weekend as a full-time experience? Without alternative energy sources, without tough standards in the auto industry, this is a ghost of commuting future. And in terms of speaking the truth to people, I'd like to insert just a paragraph here about Mitt Romney's father's auto company that frankly made terrible cars. I grew up not far from Toledo in the 50s and 60s and 70s, and my father and many of the men that I knew were auto workers. And Mitt Romney's father was the head of a merged company called American Motors. It was a merger of Nash, an automobile company, and Calvinator, a refrigerator company, and their lasting legacy to the auto industry was the Nash Rambler, which was a car that looked like a refrigerator. Later in the 70s, American Motors gave the world the Pacer and the Gremlin, and then merged with Renault so they could make lousy cars throughout the world. Romney was recently asked why the auto industry came to such dire straits in recent years, and he blamed the bloated pensions and health care of the workers. I wonder if the white-collar managers and engineers who thought Gremlins and Pacers could compete with Civics and Corollas might also have something to do with it. In fact, I think the Nash Rambler set the small car market back about 50 years, identifying in the American consumer the equivalent that a small car was a lousy car. So please, regardless of what happens this week, the conversation on global warming and all the things that go with it, taxing carbon emissions, fracking, developing safer uses for coal, nuclear, and wind, need to be a much larger part of the public conversation, and the Kardashians, the Honey Bobos, and yes, even the A-Rods need to be a much smaller part. I've paid a little bit more attention to fracking since we built a small house up in the Poconos. The problem with fracking is that our legal system is organized so that individuals can own land on which they can frack, but the water underneath it is not owned by individuals, but in fact shows very clearly the interconnectedness and interdependence of, of what we have, because the water supply is everybody's water supply. And if I pollute my water supply, yours will be polluted soon afterwards. It's a problem we have in the legal system that we need to address, not just an environmental and scientific problem. One of the great ironies of this current administration is that the first black president has spoken less about racism as an overt topic than in any administration in my lifetime, which reaches back to Truman. Yet racism as a fact has in some ways been the central theme of the Obama administration. I don't blame President Obama for not talking about race. I know from sad experience that talking about racism doesn't do much to tear it down, but actions do, and in this area, I give the president and his family high marks for having done some tremendous things to tear down racism in a million ways, large and small, and I salute their courage and intelligence. Michelle's emphasis on obesity, for instance, reminds me clearly of the attacks on smoking that began in the 1970s and received the same kind of ridicule and opposition. I hope this will have the same results and will not take 20 or 30 years to do it. But it does show that changing hearts and minds is not done politically so much as sociologically. It is not done by speaking truth to power, but by speaking truth to the people, each to the other. Which brings me to the most shameful example of racism of all. The Republican Party's continued pandering to racist votes and racist policies, from Richard Nixon's Southern strategy to Mitch McConnell's avowed first priority of making the first black president a one-term president. Future historians will call Congress from 2010 to 2012 the second nullification era. Nullification historically referred to a state's refusal to honor federal law. This has occurred several times in U.S. history, most prevalently in the South right before the Civil War. Nullification, in this case, was among the causes of the Civil War. The second nullification is the U.S. Congress refusing to accept the authority of the United States President. And it's not because he's a socialist, unless you believe that Jackie Robinson was the first socialist to play Major League Baseball. I was so proud 4 years ago when a black man was elected president. I hope someday in my lifetime to see a black president who is accorded the respect and authority that every other U.S. president has received. I hope a second Obama term might be different. If not in the attitudes of Congress, then in the attitude of the president, to feel more free to speak the truth, both to power and to people. And if by vote or another constitutional usurpation of power, we awake to see a President Romney, we must remember in either case, in politics, it ain't over even after it's over. I remember so clearly as a young man believing that once the George Wallaces and Strom Thurmonds were dead, racism would die with them. How mistaken I was, because I had not realized that when the Wallace and Thurmonds died, the Thurgood Marshalls and William O. Douglases would also have passed. Racism has, of course, managed to recede in some areas of American life while taking even deeper, more intransigent and hidden roots in other areas. I ended my election sermon in 2008 with these words from Martin Luther King's last Sunday sermon, the last day of March in 1968, the National Cathedral in Washington. As I get older and perhaps a bit wiser, I realize it may well be the appropriate way to end all election sermons. In it, he quotes three Unitarians and one English skeptic who was Emerson's good friend. Dr. King said, "We shall overcome because the arc of a moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. We shall overcome because Thomas Carlyle is right. No lie can live forever. We shall overcome because William Cullen Bryant is right. Truth crushed to earth will rise again. We shall overcome because James Russell Lowell is right in his poem adapted to our hymn today. Truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne. Yet that scaffold sways the future, and behind the demon known stands a God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own." May we join together in our closing hymn, number 160.